At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Political Science. Today I'm speaking with Paul Kenny, professor of political science at the Institute for Humanities and Social Sciences at Australian Catholic University. Paul is the author of Why Populism? Political Strategy from Ancient Greece to the Present. This book takes a novel approach, not asking why voters might prefer populists over other types of political leaders, but rather why politicians might choose populism as a strategy. As Paul puts, this is a book about the supply side of political choices, not the demand side. Paul, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. You know, this was a really fascinating book, and what I appreciated about it most was that you took a topic that is much discussed, and you flipped it on its head, and really went through so many examples, which I just thought really strengthened the approach that you offer. But before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
So I'm a political scientist and an economist by training, and I try to bring both of those disciplinary lenses to this book, and I think that will come out as we discuss it. So I went to Yale to do my PhD in political science, and while I was there, I became fascinated by India and its transition to democracy, and that really got me interested in the topic of populism. So when I went to India to do my research, I became fascinated by Indira Gandhi, who's one of the populists that I have written about in the past, and that's sort of been the trajectory that's brought me to populism in the West as well.
And for this particular book, how did the idea for it come about?
So, building off what I just mentioned about writing of Indira Gandhi, she was never the most sort of the hottest topic whenever I would talk to audiences in the West about this. It seemed like just sort of some historical concern, or maybe that populism was just a problem for countries like India or those in Latin America in particular. And they couldn't understand how my approach, bringing this economic lens to it, would apply in somewhere like Western Europe or North America. When I tried to talk to audiences about this and sort of suggest, oh, this could really apply, that really ended up pushing me towards writing about it. I actually had to show it to put it on paper. And that's what this book tries to do.
So, you know, for those of us who are in America, populism has been associated very significantly with Donald Trump. But as you discuss in the book, populism isn't just one political program. It's not one political leader. It has many different forms, different faces that it's taken throughout history. So, you know, in as general sense as possible, how would you describe or define populism?
So for me, populism is not an idea. It's not an ideology. It's not even a style exactly, as some other people have suggested. For me, it's a political strategy. And it's one in which you get this personalistic or charismatic leader who tries to appeal directly to the people. So it incorporates this notion of the people that's central to populism, but it's about something that political leaders do. Exactly something they say, it's not something they believe, but it's the way in which they try to mobilize the people directly. And what I mean by that is that they don't use political parties, they don't use patronage, they don't try to buy votes exactly, they don't try to bring people into these complex political organizations. What they try to do is talk to them directly. Today, obviously, they talk to them directly through things like Twitter, through the mass media, going back a little bit through radio, going back before that through pamphlet papers, going back before that through speeches, especially in the public sphere. So populism is a way of doing politics, and it's trying to, shall we say, outflank or outmaneuver or go over the heads of the political establishment to get this direct rapport between the leader and their followers.
You mentioned briefly in that answer two other political strategies, a strategy that you might refer to, or as you refer to in the book, as a programmatic political strategy, and then also the patronage strategy. And I think that these three are really useful. So I was wondering if you could compare the populist political strategy to the programmatic political strategy and the patronage strategy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not the first to kind of coin these ideas or forms of political organization. Really, it goes back to Max Weber, the famous political sociologist. And the idea here is that you can have a programmatic or bureaucratic type of linkage. And in the West, this is the one that we tend to think about. It's the way, historically, at least in the post-war or most of the 20th century period, I should say, the classic American political parties have been organized. And the idea of a bureaucratic party is that roles matter more than individuals. And you have things like a party whip, you have party leaders, you have offices within the party. And there's a kind of ladder that people progress up through the bureaucratic party. Externally, the party is linked to voters through organizations. So on the left, you have the classic organizations like labor unions in particular. On the right, you tend to have sort of agricultural kind of unions, farmers unions, you have business associations, and especially you have churches. And so bureaucratic political organizations, or programmatic ones, as I sometimes call them in the book, they're very well-organized, hierarchical, and deeply institutionalized. And this stands in pretty stark contrast to the sort of charismatic or direct linkages you get with a populist political leader. The other type of organization I discuss is a patronage-based political party. And historically, these are probably the most common. That programmatic party structure that we see in North America and Western Europe is the more unusual one. Patronage-based parties rely on clientelism to link with voters. Essentially, that means they buy votes. Sometimes this is literally like handing out cash before an election. In places like Indonesia, they call this the morning attack. They give out these brown paper envelopes full of money. And then you also then get brokers or people who hand out the cash and who hold this block of voters. They then in turn sell those blocks of votes higher up, and in turn, until you get to the political candidate themselves. So it's a kind of a complex sort of organization in which these factions are brought together through the distribution of money. Very often, you'll find that this cash is built from public sources. So people will use, control over a ministry, control over some particular government funds to build up their own political a faction. And, historically, we've seen this in the United States, especially in the 19th century. But it's the sort of modus operandi of most new political parties around the world after democracy tends to be introduced. Populism then is quite a contrast to this as well, in that it doesn't rely on this sort of pyramidal or feudal sort of structure in which, kind of resources flow down the network and votes or support flow back up. What populists try to do is to link directly with voters and cut out all of those middlemen. So Indira Gandhi, who I mentioned, Prime Minister of India, she literally said she was going to go over the heads of the old party bosses and link directly with the people. And the problem for a political leader with who relies on patronage is that a lot of these brokers are quite unreliable. You can't trust them. They'll very often sell their votes to more than one candidate at the same time. So here we start to see the elements of my argument, which is that populism tries to lower the cost of winning votes.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that and the sort of the economic framework that you take to analyzing populism and different political strategies. And you use an essay or ideas promoted by Ronald Coase about transaction costs. I was wondering if you could describe what transaction costs are. And how they appear in politics.
Yeah, it took me quite a while to arrive at this framework. I'd written another book called Populism in Southeast Asia. And in that book, I'd suggested that populism was a low-cost strategy. But people would ask me, how? Why? What makes it lower cost? And And I started to go back through some of the writings that I covered in my economic training, and Coase's structure really appealed to me. The idea of transaction cost economics shifts what we normally think about costs a little bit, and in a very important way for politics. So I use some economic examples or examples from the business world to help explain what I mean by transaction costs. So if we think about an organization or a firm like Ford, we can think about every product they make as having two types of cost. So the first type are the sort of direct costs that we can usually think of. These are things like the cost of the metal that goes into the car, the cost of the rubber, the cost of paying suppliers of, you know, electricity and all of the other kind of elements that will go into physically producing a car. But the costs for producing a car are also indirect. And these are kind of transaction costs. What we mean by this are the costs of making and enforcing contracts and search costs. So these transaction costs refer to things like every time you want to produce the car, you need to hire labor to engage in physical activity. So each time you wanted to produce a car, if you had to go out, find a particular laborer with the specialized skills, that entails a search cost. Then you have to make an a contract for that laborer to perform a particular activity. Then you've got to follow up to make sure that they have performed it exactly as you want it. And all of this is, it entails a great amount of cost for you as the person trying to produce a good. In this case, it's far cheaper for you to just hire someone to perform a whole range of tasks that involves just one contract. So here you get the sort of classic employment relationship. So it lowers transaction costs by making just one contract instead of many. When we bring this over to politics, we can think about the currency, if you like, as being votes. So the question is, you know, what are the transaction costs involved in winning a vote, in winning support? And, you know, with patronage, with clientelism, that cost is very obvious. Very often it is literally handing out an envelope full of cash, or literally, you know, providing a job which comes with some sort of remuneration to somebody who will support you. But there's an indirect cost or a transaction cost, even with something like clientelism. So somebody will promise to give a vote in return for, you know, $5, $10. But how do you ensure that they've actually done it? You need to be able to monitor people. And that monitoring is a transaction cost. You need to be able to enforce the fact that you have bought those votes. So not only are voters often disloyal, but so are the brokers, as I mentioned. And when you bring all of that, you know, up a scale to the county level, to the state level, and so on, the transaction costs for patronage are really quite substantial. So what a populist will try to do is to lower those transaction costs, to lower the cost of winning votes. And what we'll see, you know, as we discuss some other cases, is that they do this fairly successfully. So even though things like television advertising do cost money, they cost less than building a party or than buying votes.
So the first examples that you look at are examples of populists in ancient times. And I was, you know, I think it's always important to show this, especially when we're talking about modern day political issues. It's always great to go back as far as you can, I think, and find some of the earlier precedents and then compare them, because oftentimes they can be extremely illuminating. So what did populism look like in ancient times?
Yeah, for me, it was you know, really quite fun to go back and read some of the original sources and see, could I find populism in the earliest democracies? So, we know that there were many city-states in ancient Greece that had democratic or quasi-democratic structures, but the one we know most about, obviously, is Athens. That's really where most of the source material survives. So I can really only talk about ancient Athens, and then eventually moving on to Rome. In Athens, you had something like a participatory democracy, in the sense that all adult men, free men, could participate in the political process. This developed sort of gradually over time. It shifted from an oligarchy, where you had an elite that controlled politics, to becoming more participatory and a greater number of policy areas, especially over war and over taxation, moved into the assembly in Greece. And regular people had an actual say in how politics worked. This isn't to say that, you know, every single, Joe Soap could stand up and make a speech. That's not how things worked. The elite still were the ones who led, but it meant that they spoke directly in the assembly to thousands of other gathered men. And this meant that the strength of a particular speech could actually sway the vote. It was quite a sort of emotional process. And we hear, you know, stories of brilliant speakers in ancient Greece who were able to sway the crowd one way or another to their particular policy. So it catered exactly to this type of charismatic leader. There were no political organizations, even though there was possibly a little bit of vote buying. Most of this occurred with people just sort of shifting their allegiance according to who would make the better speech at a particular moment. And, you know, often this was, you know, lamented by the elite because it created the opportunity for rabble rousers to sort of come along to make these sort of dramatic speeches to whip people up, especially when it came to declaring war. When you move on to Rome, things look a little bit different. You do have the forum. There were public speeches in the cantiones, but these operated slightly differently in that policy was still decided within the Senate. And you had very clear executive leadership in the consuls, the famous two dual consulship that characterized the Roman political system. And so it was, there was much more of a separation between the political leadership and the people. It was, you know, very clearly filtered through this, you know, aristocratic Senate. But this isn't to say that the people had no say whatsoever. So, you know, the mob or the crowd still gathered in Rome. It could still exert a force, but very often it was more on the edges of legality. So you have political outsiders who try to use the crowd, who try to use this popular support to pressure the elite to get their way, to worm their way up the political ladder. So the famous examples are beginning with the Gracchi and going all the way up to Clodius towards the end, around the time of Caesar.
The third chapter of your book looks at populism during the American and French revolutions. Who are the big populists of these periods, and how did they compare to the populists of ancient times?
So the American and French revolutions are, it's fascinating how they occur so close in time, but they really transpire very, very differently. The American Revolution, for all its sort of ideological fervor, was in a way quite conservative. And it doesn't really generate any successful populace. Colonial era elite is really the same elite that continues to rule throughout the revolutionary period and then on into independence. So we don't really see any populace until the middle of the 19th century in the American case. France is very different because it's a much more revolutionary, if you like, revolution. This is in the sense that it completely overturns the political order. So the aristocracy, rather than being the elite that continues into the new period, is completely overthrown. And so some of them enter into the new legislative assemblies, but very quickly they're outflanked by this new bourgeoisie. These are a sort of professional class without the old kind of patronage networks of the aristocracy. And they mobilize very, very different. So we get immediately characters like Danton, like Robespierre, who people probably would know better. And what they sought to do was to appeal directly to the crowd, and especially directly to the crowd in Paris. And this is where just even a few thousand people mobilized on the streets could cause a whole lot of mayhem, not just the storming of the Bastille, but very often they could appear right outside the legislative assembly and be able to pressure the elite into doing what the crowd wanted. And leaders like Danton could channel this sort of popular energy, even if they couldn't always control it.
I want to ask a question. You can also describe this, you know, some of the examples that we've already discussed, but you can pick up on any examples that you think might be relevant on just the relationship between populism and democracy, and whether or not populism is a true form of democracy, or whether populism is a kind of corrupted form of democracy.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and it's sort of something I'm working on more now. It's not exactly something that I address in full in the book, but my thoughts on it are this, that in some ways populism can be pro-democratic, and that's something that I do talk about in the book. And that's where populism is often a tool of the outsider. So very often elites, the wealthy, but not those who are exactly in power. If you're in power, you have very little motivation to engage in that kind of populism. You don't want to be whipping up the crowd. You want to be demobilizing the crowd. So populism is a tool of the outsider. And in that sense, it can be democratizing. So very often what they'll try to do is to bring in new voters to expand the franchise. And even with, Andrew Jackson, who we might talk about a little bit further, he's able to come to power to win power in the late 1820s because the franchise has expanded. And so as democracy expands, as there are more new voters, as more new voters are mobilized and brought into the system, and these were the people that Jackson appealed to, especially those in the West, that has a democratizing effect. More people are participating. And this is something that populists will often try and do. So where there's a kind of a neglected part of the electorate or a body of people that hasn't yet got the franchise, whether because of age or because of some kind of citizenship requirement, populists are often the one to push to get them involved. And that goes all the way back even to the Gracchi in Rome as well. They sort of made themselves the voice of this kind of neglected or ignored people. So that's the sort of potentially good side of populism. But for me, ultimately, it ends up generally having more negative consequences. And that's because populists often run sort of roughshod over the institutions that check the majority will. So, you know, we could go back to Madison or others who saw these kind of, they're often called liberal institutions, but what's meant by them is institutions that prevent the majority from dominating over a minority. So as Madison kind of hypothesized that, you know, you could have the 51% enslave the other 49%. And then once that 49% is enslaved, a majority of the remaining 51% could enslave the rest again, until you basically have a tyranny of a tiny few. So you always need some kind of protections for any democracy to work, some protections for the minority. They have to be able to organize politically so that someday the minority can itself become the majority. What populists try to do is to, they try to mitigate this checking or balancing role of political institutions. So they'll very often privilege the executive over the legislature, to say that, well, look, I as one individual embody the people's will, and these institutions like an independent court, an independent legislature are illegitimate. They don't embody the people's will. So that's what makes populism for me dangerous to democracy.
What is the sort of sense in which populists are able to pick up on, this kind of duality of both actually being popular, but also then needing to take apart the checks, as you were saying, in order to maintain their power?
Yeah, populists are they're often just sometimes called authoritarians or quasi-authoritarians or, you know, illiberal democrats, or these sort of funny kind of hybrid terms, because they seem to sit somewhere between democracy and authoritarianism. But very often they really are democratic when they come to power. They win elections, but as you pointed out in your question there, they typically win when just a plurality is enough. They are rarely popular enough or rarely able to get sort of genuine majorities in the initial instance. And in Trump's case, you had an extremely divided field, and he's able to win with the smallest plurality of any victor since the GOP introduced the primary process. And so by winning, needing to win fewer votes, this obviously lowers the cost for Trump. So the fewer votes that you have to win, the less it costs. So And the more cheaply you can win those votes, the less it costs as well. Things change sort of when they get into power. What they want to do in that case then is to deal with the fact that they don't have an organization to control their supporters. So unlike a political party where people are members of that party, they say they join the Labour Party, they go to the Labour pub, they're in the Labour Union, they live in a set of row houses where all their neighbours are members of this union, they all vote the same way. So it's a very sort of social process and people are deeply embedded into it. And they're going to vote that way pretty much all the time. But populists can't rely on that because they rely on things like television. These are very weak links to voters. So they can't be sure that those same voters are going to continue to turn out next time. So populism is not a very good way of keeping voters. It's a good way of initially getting them. And so because of that, populists have this great temptation to sort of erode democracy to prevent another populist or another political party from beating them at the next election. So in so many cases, what you see is populists start to chip away at the ability of the opposition to organize after they've got into power. And it tends to be the case that the longer they're there, the more successfully they're able to chip away at those constraints on executive power and on the ability of the opposition to organize.
How might we think about different types of populists like Trump on the right, Bernie Sanders on the left, and, you know, Emmanuel Macron in the center?
So for me, the kind of more usually described political ideology, whether it's in economic terms on the left or right or center, or whether they're, you know, very obviously nationalist or not, you know, these things are sort of additions to populism. Populism is a way of doing politics. And we see populists adopt different kind of strategies, different messages in different contexts, but the method is the same. So for instance, to take a very different example, you've got Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. So for him, he triumphed on a law and order message, well, what he calls law and order, but essentially a tough on drugs and a tough on drug crime sort of message. So there was no particular nationalist message, there was no particular economic message, but the way in which he mobilized supporters was 100% populism. With other leaders, you see different kinds of messages from Hitler on his rise to power, or from Bernie Sanders on the, you know, far left, emphasizing a redistributionist economic message that has more in common with the likes of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, where you have those again sort of on the right, or even who are quite unclear in their messaging, like Donald Trump, who tend to stress more nationalistic sort of messages than any particular economic one. So the actual content of the populist appeal for me is quite open. It's, you know, talk, if you like, is cheap, and they'll say what they need to say. And Trump himself was a great experimenter. He would throw out different messages to see which ones stuck, and he'd continue with those. So for me, populists are sort of really empty when it comes to content. They'll fill it with whatever they need to mobilize the crowd, and they'll often experiment to see with what works.
Are there other ways in which you are taking sort of economic ideas or frameworks to understanding populism that we haven't already discussed?
Yeah, so there's a few that I throw in to the book that help explain particular dynamics that make it possible for populists to win. So, you know, one of the good examples, I think, is, you know, why would clientelism or patronage be successful at one point in keeping populists out, and then seemingly all of a sudden fail to allow populists in? So we could look at something like the Italian political system. This was the classic clientelistic or patronage-based political system. You have the Christian Democratic Party. That's the dominant political force from the post-war period right the way through up until 1990 or so. And then at this point, Silvio Berlusconi bursts onto the political scene. So why does the Italian political system implode? We know in that case that there was a big corruption scandal, that members of the Christian Democratic Party were just sort of deeply engaged in corrupt relationships with businessmen, buying votes, engaged with the mob. He was incredibly corrupt, and the Italian political system just implodes at this point. The DC completely vanishes. All of the old political parties essentially vanish, and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia comes along in the mid 1990s to take over. And Italy has never really had a stable party system since, and we've seen this sort of recurrent emergence of populism. But why does the political system collapse in the first place? So economics, I think, can give us some insight into this. So why is it that in the early phases, patronage works? Well, it's fairly low cost, and most of those costs can be borne from the exchequer, from public sources. So you're able to provide jobs, you're able to maybe provide some kind of cash for some other sort of benefits, or a promise of intervening with the bureaucracy in some way. So candidates in a party can use these sort of inducements, typically financial, but sometimes other inducements, to keep a block of supporters together. And this can kind of cohere into a patronage party, as these factions are bought together by giving out ministries and other public contracts and so on. The problem, though, as I mentioned, is that brokers, or these guys in the middle, are often disloyal. So you're willing to take your faction and your block of voters and sell it to another leader. So what you see in systems like the Italian one is that very few leaders can stay at the top for long, because factions are willing to sell their block of votes to another leader who'll give them a better ministry, for instance, where they can bilk off more funds. And so you see in the Italian system that, governments, prime ministers basically change, almost one a year, or even more than one a year, because of this sort of disloyalty of those even from within their own party. And because brokers are sort of willing and able to be so disloyal, the cost of buying their votes tends to ratchet upwards. And you tend to have this sort of effect whereby the cost of keeping power goes up and up and up and up, which increases the amount of corruption over time to be able to continue to buy off these voters. So the Italian political system has this quality where the cost of staying in power goes up and up and up and up and up, and then rival political parties come along. Sometimes they break away. Coalitions are then developed between factions and different patronage parties, and the cost of this continues to go up and up and up and up, and eventually it becomes unsustainable. And in the Italian case, it just collapses under its own weight, where the corruption is so out of control that it can no longer be hidden. And then this creates the opportunity for someone like Berlusconi to be able to say, hey, look, I'll sweep out the old elite. Don't mind these corrupt guys. We'll just have this direct link between me, the clean, upstanding leader, and you, the supporters. And this is the sort of kind of classic dynamic whereby the costs of patronage have this upward ratcheting quality that populists can promise to sort of cut through that kind of Gordian knot.
My last question is a more general question, just about the present moment and the current state of populism. Obviously, 2016, Brexit and Trump and other elections, it was kind of maybe a peaking moment for populism. And now it seems like populism, the wave may have crested. Do you get that, without having, without asking you to predict the future or anything like that, do you get the sense or the feeling that populism is something that is going to maybe for in the short term recede into the past? Or do you think that populism is something that is still alive and well, and that is something that could easily rear its head again?
Unfortunately, I think it's the latter. I think populism is pretty here to stay in the short term, because if we look at what are the alternatives? Patronage, as I've just been describing, is quite cost ineffective. It's not really a way to manage democracy in the West. It's far too expensive. Very few credible political actors can really pursue that strategy in the West anymore. What then of bureaucratic parties? Well, they're really not in a good condition, as a lot of other writers who I draw on in the book have talked about. So party memberships have absolutely tanked everywhere. Peter Mayer, the very famous Irish political scientist, had written about this a long time ago, as long ago as the 90s and the 80s. The political parties were really hemorrhaging members. Labor unions are really sort of still in decline, not just in America, but in Western Europe. And so, and churches, of course, for those parties on the right, Christian Democratic parties, they've been really losing members quite substantially. So this has created a very large body of voters that are no longer really attached in a deep way to political parties. So they'll vote for a liberal party one day, a conservative party the next, or maybe something more radical, in the British case, like UKIP, in the election after that. So because there's very little loyalty now, and an embedded sort of loyalty in a social kind of way, that people have real deep links to political parties, because that's become a thing of the past, and we haven't developed new kinds of links between people and parties, I think populists are always going to find a way in, because these voters can be mobilized quite cheaply. So, some popular celebrity who's already well known, someone with an awful lot of money who can quickly develop name recognition, it's very easy for them to win over these weakly attached sort of voters. So, until the prospects for new kinds of party, not that they have to be exactly like the ones of old, but other new kinds of more stable political linkages that reflect the way that we live and work today, until those kind of political links develop, where perhaps people have more ownership over their party, where they can participate in a real sort of way in the organization and the ongoings of their party, perhaps using new kinds of technology. When those things are sort of developed and people become more bonded to new style political parties, then I think maybe you could see this appeal or cost effectiveness of populism start to ebb away. But for the present period, while parties remain so deeply unpopular, I think it means that the populist wave may not even have crested yet.
In the wake of this project, are you continuing an examination of populism, or are you exploring any other new topics?
So both. I'm also writing another new short book, Populism, What Everyone Needs to Know, for Oxford. So this is going to be a shorter examination and something that, reassesses the just massive literature out there on populism. So I hope it'll be useful to people as a sort of first way in. But I want to talk in that book not just about how populists come to power, as I do in this book, but also about what populists do when they get to power. So it'll be a kind of broad examination of the whole kind of populist phenomenon. But beyond that, I'm also looking at other issues like personalist dictatorship, which is a little bit related, but how dictators manage to use institutions and use rules to keep power and to personalize power. So there's a bit of a paradox there that again we see dictators follow some of these economic rules, if you like, so to use the institutions that are there to their advantage in the most cost-effective way. But again, most of my research, I could talk about others, but it again tries to apply some of this microeconomic theoretical lenses to political questions.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you.